Thank you for calling the Bombas Comfort Line. Bombas make socks, slippers, tees, and underwear made with the highest quality materials. Press 1 for comfort, 2 for style, 3 for donation.
You chose style. Bombas is styles for whatever you enjoy. You can run in Bombas, lounge in Bombas, dress them up, dress them down, but always give back in Bombas. Because with every item purchased, another is donated. Bombas, comfort worth calling for. Go to bombas.com/audio and use code AUDIO for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com and use code AUDIO.
This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Delivering on the returns, increasing our margins.
Ratings go down the toilet if I'm not here.
All I do is simply put the math in my favor.
We agree that Brandon and John do good work.
The reason is simple wrestling economics.
Told the Netflix numbers. I've been told the metrics a little bit, probably five different times. I still don't get it.
There were respectable wrestling journalists who needed answers.
Thank you very much, members of the media. I hope you all go to hell.
How about we pop a number right here, right now?
A whole part of the show, man.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Pollock and Thurston, your co-production of Post Wrestling and WrestleNomics. Here we are on Wednesday, December the 17th. How are you, Brandon?
I'm fine. How are you?
Well, it's a new era.
Is it?
It's the post John Cena era of Pollock and Thurston.
He looked very serene as he tapped out.
He did. He did. Man at peace.
Yes. You know, I did watch this match. I did even put my phone down for most of it, almost all of it. Wow. I don't know. I did watch this match. I understand there's been some controversy, however, coming from the match. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What's the controversy?
I've heard that there's differing opinions and different perspectives on John Cena losing.
Oh, I see. Well, certainly, this is all part of the show. This is what we do. That's who I defer to, right?
Yes. I mean, if I were had to make this decision, that's what I would have expected. And you're having your last match, and you're very insistent that this is your last match. Yeah, that's what I would want to do.
To lose.
Yeah.
I think that it's a finish that it is, I don't know, this many days removed, I didn't have like a whole big issue with it. And I think overall, I think the discussion has kind of fueled this match that this is going to be one of those finishes that is going to be debated back and forth with people, much like the Undertaker's streak, which I don't see as a negative. You know, Gunther, where this guy is propelled in 2026 remains to be seen as what he gains from this. But Monday would certainly tell you that he was, you know, on Monday, he felt like the biggest star in the company coming out like this, that he was elevated to a brand new level. But, you know, that's the same reaction Roman Reigns got after beating The Undertaker at WrestleMania. And that was not a smooth transition, being the second person to beat The Undertaker at WrestleMania and where his 2017 ended up being.
This does. I mean, this thing is retirement is the counterexample where he went out winning. With a tag partner, so you kind of have Darby Allin get some of that rub, but it does give me hesitance to say, well, I don't. Well, okay, so and so is retiring, and it seems like everybody's in line now to get their big retirement run.
Oh yeah, this is like Lucha. It's like you want to get your big payday to give your mask up or get your head shaved on the way out. Who's gonna be who? And the funny part is in WWE, it's like an AJ Styles, Brock Lesnar. I mean, they're not going to get anything above and beyond for a retirement. They're just going to get, you know, they'll get a nice platform for it. And now we have
they'll get the Goldberg treatment.
That's it. Maybe with a little more runtime on the Peacock end.
Yes. Yeah. No, but it does give me pause about like, well, it just seems like the default right thing to do to lose in your last match. But maybe this is a counterexample to think about. Maybe not.
I think you're serving different audiences. Like, for that crowd on that night, if you want to send them home happy, John Cena winning is the route toward that. They're not necessarily booking for the night. Paul Levesque is clearly booking for next year's WrestleMania or next year's SummerSlam or a year from now with Gunther. Like, Sting's retirement was done excellent. Like, he went over, and I don't think anyone would have argued that the Bucks winning that match would have been the right thing for AEW's business, for the night in Greensboro. But if, let's say, 2 months out, it had been Darby Allin just saying, Sting, I've been by your side this whole time. I need to test myself against you. And it was Sting against Darby in the retirement match. I think you'd have a much more deeper debate about whether or not you put Sting over in that kind of a situation, which is closer to what this was, rather than the presentation for Sting and teaming with Darby and that feel-good moment that AEW had last year.
This is, at least primarily, in the beginning, initially, about the live response, right? And I guess, had this been SummerSlam or WrestleMania, where you're there to see a wider variety of selling points for WWE. This was, yes, a Saturday Night's main event, but this was strongly promoted as this is where John Cena's last match is. So if you're a John Cena super fan, and then that's why we're going to Events DC and having them do whatever they did in our partnership with Events DC, because you're gonna fly in, you're gonna stay at the hotels and restaurants and whatever. And you're a John Cena super fan, and then you're going to pay God knows what for a ticket. New arena record, I understand. So, you know, it, had this been a John Cena retirement match on a major pay-per-view, maybe the vocal backlash to one Paul Levesque who had the audacity to saunter his way to the ring would have been different.
Yeah, the let it be known that the last image is John Cena salutes to the crowd and walks into the sunset, into the back, is Events DC on the wall there. That was the final image of the night. Do you think that audiences had more of an issue, not amazing for our video viewers, had more issue with the way in which John, not the idea of John Cena losing, but the way in which he lost with the tap, giving up at the end, or it was just they were there to celebrate John Cena and... It was unique just because we have not seen this reaction to a WWE booking decision in this era of
TKO. I think it was primarily him losing. It does maybe the never give up and him tapping out maybe added to it, but I think regardless, that audience was primed to turn on Paul Levesque at least if he did not win.
Well, it's going to be funny. I was talking to Wei about this the other night. Is that we're probably going to see a very similar, like, execution of Hiroshi Tanahashi's retirement. Like, I do not see Tanahashi beating Okada in the main event of Wrestle Kingdom, where you have around 45,000 people. This is clearly for Tanahashi's retirement. It's going to be an emotional spectacle. And I, like, certainly...
Well, he will be booing Gato. Gato will be the one who will be the recipient.
I don't know if they'll be chanting "You effed up" at Gato. Maybe they will. Maybe they'll finally just wreak havoc on the House of Torture booking. I can't say Tanahashi, there's no way they put him over, but I'd be pretty stunned if Tanahashi won this retirement. And you're probably going to get the same type of outcome in that scenario as well, in front of what's going to be New Japan's biggest audience in decades, between the live event and the fact that this is going to be broadcast in Japan as well. Like, this is going to be a huge attention grabbing event for New Japan. It's going to be the most relevant they've been in minimum 5 years.
I don't expect a similar backlash in Japan for New Japan, and I do expect Tanahashi to lose, especially given it's Okada, who's not a New Japan wrestler. He's being loaned by your partner. I doubt that AEW would be so excited to do this if Okada was going to lose.
Well, let's stay on the Cena front, because this was an enormous event that WWE promoted. As Brandon said, this went far beyond just a Saturday night's main event. This very much was the John Cena retirement ceremony. And they went to the Capital One Arena, the home of the very first episode of AEW Dynamite. And here we were, the launch of Dynamite and the farewell to Cena, all in the same building. And the day after, Paul Levesque thanking the Capital One Arena, stating that Saturday night's main event was not simply the highest grossing WWE arena event ever, but the highest grossing event ever at the Capital One Arena. Take that, Ovechkin. Take that, AEW. WWE, jacking those prices up. The last number we had from WrestleTix was 19,176. And what would have been the previous record that this would have eclipsed to be the number one arena event in WWE history?
4.8 million for the Raw debut on Netflix at the Intuit Dome. I will double check that, but I believe 4.8 million. So we're talking about a gate that must have been $5 million or very close to it.
If we go with $5 million, that's roughly an average of $261 a ticket for the show. And when you see...
That's a WrestleMania ticket in a previous era.
Yeah, and you could argue this, I mean, this was, in terms of a demand for a show, like this was not maybe like if they put a WrestleMania into an arena, but this was pretty damn high. And it's, we will not know what the numbers are on Peacock for this, but I would have been really curious how much this would have done on NBC, for instance, because this was certainly one of the biggest attractions WWE has had in years. Like, you can only do this retirement with John Cena once. I mean, people in wrestling history might tempt that theory, but this, I just feel like we're kind of inundated in our own little like wrestling bubbles. But this just to me broke through to lots of audiences on Saturday. It seemed like a lot of people were, this was on their radar.
I watched a wrestling match, so I think that is the litmus test.
Jeff Merrick watched this retirement of John Cena. I mean, when I'm getting texts from Jeff Merrick, that's not only watching this retirement match, but then seeking out our post show afterwards. Mind blowing.
Yeah, it would have been very interesting to see what it would have done on NBC. I'm sure it would have been the most highly viewed of this run, this round of Saturday Night's main events, but that's 2 million viewers is the benchmark for that.
So John Cena will now go off into the sunset and we will see where Gunther is poised now. I mean, to me, he came out as this just megastar on Monday on Raw. And certainly the discussion, I think it's just like amplified this. I think there's a lot of interest in Gunther and how you follow this up. But it also does sort of also look at 2026. Like, you do have the pending retirement of AJ Styles. You have the speculation about if Brock Lesnar will wind things down. I don't know how a Brock Lesnar retirement tour really, I don't know how you do that one. It's a weird one. And of course, like, if he ends up going to WWE, like, Chris Jericho will be in a similar boat, but I don't think anything is going to come into the proximity of this. Like, John Cena was as we talked about last year, like, such a central figure, but there is a lot of value in these retirements when they're promoted well and audiences see these retirement matches as historical events that they want to be part of and that they will spend ridiculous amounts of money for, because it crosses over from just being a wrestling show with great matches and peaks of rivalries to something in history that you want to be a part of. And as we have seen, like, that is stuff.
History is a draw.
That draws. History is a huge draw. You wanted to be at that first All In, not because of any one particular match, but because of the concept and being there.
And I think the first AEW All In at Wembley had, yes, it drew tens of thousands of people in its own right. And then I think there's sort of a cumulative effect of like, oh, it's going to be this really highly attended event. I really want to be there. It's the AEW's first stadium event. It turns out to be the most, well, it turns out to have 81,035 tickets sold according to AEW. And you want to be there to be a part of it. I think the New Japan show at Madison Square Garden is another case like that.
Yeah, I think that was, you know, a huge thing. Like, you didn't know what was going to be on that card, but it was just significant. I mean, you did, those tickets went on sale before the whole exodus of talent from ROH, but nonetheless, that was a show that, you know, it was the historical nature of a non-McMahon promoted show at Madison Square Garden, with due respect to AAA in 2019, who would also run it later that year. Didn't have quite the same success as ROH in New Japan. We will be getting to the Ring Boy lawsuit, because that was a big story over the past week. But let's shift focus to WBD, because, man, the plot thickens, Brandon. We had filings from all entities. The WBD shareholders have now rejected the $108 billion bid from Paramount Skydance and have reiterated their support of the Netflix offer. So to recap, Netflix's deal for the streaming and studios properties of Warner Brothers Discovery, minus the soon-to-be spun-off Discovery Global, their bid is valued at $27.75 per share. Paramount then came in with a hostile bid of $30 per share, but for the entirety of Warner Brothers Discovery. I was about to say destruction, which is maybe more apropos. Just throw everything into a box. We'll take everything. Okay. No need to weed out the crap. So WBD has stated that it has unanimously determined that the tender offer launched by Paramount Skydance on December 8th is not in the best interests of WBD and its shareholders and does not meet the criteria of a superior proposal under the terms of WBD's merger agreement with Netflix announced December 5th. The Warner Brothers Discovery Board recommends that WBD shareholders reject Paramount Skydance's offer. The terms of the Netflix merger are superior. The Paramount Skydance offer provides inadequate value and imposes numerous significant risks and costs on WBD. It also says that Paramount has consistently misled WBD shareholders that its proposed transaction has a full backstop from the Ellison family. It does not and never has. And that the most recent Skydance Paramount proposal includes a $40.65 billion equity commitment for which there is no Ellison family commitment of any kind. Instead, they propose that you rely on an unknown and opaque revocable trust for the certainty of this crucial deal funding. So Paramount's bid, of course, did have the backing of sovereign wealth funds from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Abu Dhabi, along with Affinity Partners, which is an investment firm that was founded by Jared Kushner. But on Tuesday, we learned that Jared Kushner, I'm out, guys. Affinity Partners pulled out on Tuesday. So Paramount, they're basically offering this all-cash deal. Netflix, it's 84% cash, the rest in stock. So that was the major news today. However, Paramount, not to be outdone, you would almost think, Brandon, they were ready for this. Press yes. release drafted, response, they were ready to swing back. And boy, did they. Are they just saying, fair play, we're going back, we'll figure something else out?
No, I don't have the timestamps on this, but it was, but both of these were out by the morning. Paramount affirms commitment to superior $30 per share all cash offer for WBD. As we talked about last week, they are bidding on different sets of assets, right? Paramount wants the entirety of WBD. Netflix only wants the David Zaslav. Is that what Global Networks is that they're calling? Or which one is which? I forget.
Yeah,
which
I think one Global is Networks is the studios and streaming. Discovery Global okay. is
right. Gunners. And so Netflix's deal will take up all the studios and the HBO stuff, and then that will leave Gunnar Weidenfeld's, who's the CFO for WBD, that will leave his company, including all the cable assets, out to be its own publicly traded company. Maybe that would end up doing some M&A later, but that's not going to be part of this transaction. But Paramount wants all of it. Did you get an understanding? Have you wrapped your head around what the arguments are that they're making here?
That Warner Brothers Discovery is making, or Paramount?
Both.
Warner Brothers Discovery, their argument is that this is that their $108 billion bid, it is not all guaranteed by the Ellisons, and that there are enough questions about this makeup of this $40 billion that they cannot rely on. And I think this is somewhat affirmed by the fact that Affinity Partners has already pulled out. It sounds like they would prefer, at the base level, we're not going to agree on the price here. They also do mention the fact that this would be weaker for Hollywood to go with Paramount. They're actually outlining that, which makes that's an interesting argument for WBD to make if it's just trying to create a bidding war. But I think it is mainly the fact that it is, they're going to disagree on what this Discovery Global is worth. There are different valuations of what that would be worth. And as well that the Ellisons are not committing to all of this funding as well, seems to be their major contentious issues here.
Okay. And as we talked about last week, it's a matter of opinion, I guess, how to compare these two offers, because one wants Discovery Global, aka Shitco, one doesn't, and Paramount is saying, well, we're only going to give you $1 on your share price for Discovery Global, when it's a matter of saying that half of your company is worth like 1/29th of what your entire company is, when it's worth more than that probably, but who knows how much, and that changes how you compare these two offers.
So Paramount's option now is they're at $30 a share. Are they just going to keep upping this to a point where WBD shareholders cannot turn this down? I mean, that is their option if they can go that high. But again, like the amount that, like when you look at where this stock was valued at before all the acquisition discussions began versus now, like there is a great overpaying of this company, but that is kind of part and parcel of having this these two gigantic conglomerates that both want this company. But I think you would certainly look at Paramount as they are just going to go deeper with a higher bid.
So they haven't put out a new bid yet, right? They put out this press release saying, we affirm the commitment to our superior bid. Our bid really is superior. The WBD board doesn't know what they're talking about. They haven't put out an evaluation of what Discovery Global is worth. And that tells you that you shouldn't trust them and that our bid is really better.
Do you think that Paramount's bid is handicapped by the sovereign wealth funds that are making up this this difference in the overall bid? They have gone so far as to state that the foreign entities that are involved in this bid for Paramount would relinquish any governance, no seats on the board, and that has left people very skeptical, because the overarching question is why? Why would they be putting in all of this with zero influence? Like, this is sizable amounts, like billions and billions that they would be inputting here, and that's honestly going to give, I think, most people more pause on the Paramount deal, is the idea of foreign ownership of news, of all of these, you know, communications tools that they are bidding after.
And what sovereign wealth funds is the PIF involved in this?
Yes, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Abu Dhabi, and affinity partners that are, well, domestic, but now have pulled out of their backing.
And they would be major investors in the company that owns, for example, CNN.
Yes. Well, maybe we can see how that turns out. Okay. What could go wrong?
What could go wrong?
Yes. Well, the drama continues. So this is going to give many business analysts ample fuel over the holidays. A lot of think pieces.
Netflix, because they're going through a merger here, they're sort of doing dual filings. But anyway, Netflix and WBD put out this filing, letting everybody know that Americans overwhelmingly prefer the Netflix bid. I'm hoping that the FTC defers its duty to scrutinize this and approve of it by just, we'll just have a national referendum, because Netflix is ready to go on that. They say that over half of Americans surveyed in this Morning Consult survey of 700 U.S. adults on December 8th and 9th, over half of Americans surveyed believe that Netflix should receive regulatory approval. Americans support the Netflix Warner Brothers deal by nearly 3-1. They've got the better deal. Everybody wants it in America. It's good to go.
I think this should go to a vote.
Yes. We'll put it on the ballot next November.
I think that's a great idea. Great way to get around this. Now we'll move on to the Ring Boy lawsuit. So last week we got a decision from Judge James Bredar, who has opted to allow the Ring Boy lawsuit to continue for most of the plaintiffs, but not all, as well as claims against individually Vince and Linda McMahon and WWE and by extension TKO, which we will get into. So of the 8 John Does that filed this lawsuit a year ago against all of those parties, only John Doe 7, his claims are not going to move forward because he is alleging abuse during the 70s before Vince McMahon had taken ownership of the company beginning in 1982. And then several of them have been broken down. So the claims by John Doe 7 have been dismissed without prejudice, but John Doe's 1 through 6 and 8, their claims will proceed. And then the claims among John Doe's number 1, 3 to 5 and 7 to 8, if you can keep a track at home here, against Linda McMahon have been dismissed, but 2 of the John Doe's claims against Linda will move forward. So all that is to say that the majority of the plaintiffs, that their claims are going forward against some variation of the 4 defendants.
Yeah. And a lot of this is based on what has been alleged about who had knowledge. And by the way, just to emphasize, this is not a determination from the judge about the merits of the allegations, right? Judge Bredard is not weighing in at this point about whether what they allege is true. He was making a decision in response to the defendant's motion to dismiss, which is standard in cases like this. The defendants were all arguing that they wanted this case thrown out for various reasons, including that they've said that the plaintiffs had no right to sue them in Maryland because none of them live in Maryland. Company isn't headquartered in Maryland. Company is not incorporated in Maryland. It's corporate in a different state we'll talk about later. And so they were saying, among other things, that you can't sue us in this state. And for that reason, it should be thrown out. But the judge was making determinations based on what had been alleged and whether they had plausibly made their claims well enough so that this case could continue. And as you said, there's 8 plaintiffs, 7 of 8 of them are continuing, and there's been, so 7 of the 8 will continue to argue their claims against Vince and against the company, both WWE and TKO, but only 2 of them will continue with their claims against Linda McMahon. And so something I didn't actually get into in the article is why only 2 with Linda and all the 7 still with Vince and the company. And the judge points out that, I'll just read this, that Linda McMahon's personal liability will be limited to the plaintiffs who plausibly pled they were injured after 1988. Because only John Doe's 2 and 6 allege such injuries, and the other plaintiffs' claims will be dismissed without prejudice against Linda McMahon. So what the judge is determining there is that the plaintiffs are alleging that the way that they allege this complaint is that Linda only would have had knowledge by 1988. And this is around the time, right? This is where you get the story about Mel Phillips, who is largely the one who's being accused of this abuse, where Mel Phillips was fired by WWF and then brought back weeks later. The judge is basically saying, okay, by that time, according to your allegations, she would have known and she would have had knowledge. So we're only keeping the 2 plaintiffs on who have allegations after 1988 towards Linda. The rest of the 7, they're still in this lawsuit, but their claims are not against Linda, but they're against Vince and WWE because they're saying that Vince's knowledge began much earlier in 1982 or 83. And Judge Bredard especially points to the allegation that a security guard found Mel Phillips abusing one of these ring boys in a car and brought Mel Phillips to Vince, and Vince said he would handle it.
Yeah, this incident, I'm assuming, is the same one that was brought up, among others, by Bruno Sammartino on the Donahue show, I believe it was. It was either Donahue or Larry King Live, but he had brought this up. But then when pressed on it, like Bruno had not seen it himself. Yeah. And so that's the incident in question. You could certainly make the claim that if Vince is plausibly, if you can plausibly believe that Vince McMahon had knowledge of this in 1982, you would think Linda McMahon would probably have heard that same story, but that is not the case here. Vince is
right, and I think on a legal basis, being somebody's spouse probably isn't good enough to to make these claims viable towards her. Their claims are still viable towards Vince and the company, though.
So that incident, like the key things in this 48-page ruling by the judge is the incident in either 1982 or 1983 that Vince was allegedly made aware of involving this security guard finding going to the limo and finding this boy. The 1988 story that we have talked about over and over again about Mel Phillips' dismissal by the company and subsequent rehiring on the provision that he, quote, steer clear of young boys. And like that's a significant one that would at least, like, this is from Vince McMahon on the record to Phil Mushnick and Dave Meltzer stating this as such. Like, this
and
is
Mushnick not- has testified to that under oath in a deposition.
Yes. And for what it's worth, this story that Vince McMahon, he had these separate calls with Dave Meltzer and Phil Mushnick and stated this on the record. This has never been disputed. This has never been disputed by Vince McMahon. This has never been disputed by Jerry McDivitt. Like, this has just been like this, like, it's never been denied that Vince McMahon, he is not claiming he never said this, at least not, according not yet.
Yeah, according to Jerry Millett, who is also a ring boy, who denies, you know, disbelieves the claims that have been made against Mel Phillips. According to him, his explanation of the 1988 firing is that he was that Mel was removed as the ring announcer from WF Challenge, and he got his job back after that. They came to some agreement. I believe according to Jerry Millett, Mel quit, that not that he was fired.
And that would, I mean, again, it comes to like, why would Vince McMahon position this story in that way to two reporters?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it. It's a very difficult one, I think, to parse if you're defending Vince McMahon on that, of like what that story is. And then the others are outlined in this decision are, you have David Bixenspan's story that he did for Business Insider, where there was a high-ranking executive at the time that stated that everyone was aware that this was going on. You also had a quote from Nelson Swegler, who was, you know, worked in production in the WWF in the 80s, that you know, he talked about like people having knowledge of this as well. So again, this is not like this is evidence that this happened. It's just the argument has been put forth by the plaintiffs that there is a plausible assumption that these incidents of abuse could have occurred, and that's why it's moving to discovery, and the defendants will have their opportunity to defend themselves. But the grounds of which the defendants have tried to have these charges thrown out pretty much came up empty, as with the exception of several of the claims by the John Does not applying to Linda McMahon, or with John Doe 7 because of the timing of his alleged incidents that occurred to him. They're all pretty much moving forward. Vince and Linda McMahon had argued about if Maryland is this is not in the right jurisdiction, and that was pretty much throwing down, that was not relevant because they did hundreds of shows in the state of Maryland. They taped Tuesday Night Titans in Maryland, and all of the John Does made claims that occurred within the state of Maryland, where they were under the supervision of Mel Phillips, who was working with WWF at the time and running the ring crew.
Yeah. So what they will do now is there is a deadline to answer, which they've jointly asked. The defendants will have to file an answer, which will basically be, they'll go through the complaint and either admit to or deny. And by the way, all these defendants have denied responsibility, but they will go through the complaint and either admit to or deny each factual allegation. And that will probably be on January 9th, because they've asked the judge for an extension on that. And they will move towards discovery. Sometimes things get settled as discovery starts to happen. No idea if that will happen here, but discovery would include depositions, probably mainly depositions in this case, but will also include, they could request documents, and there will be no doubt some litigation over what they will be entitled to.
And just to recap some of what is outlined here, and we are going to kind of describe some of these allegations, so be aware of that. The 8 John Does allege sexual abuse while working as ring boys, primarily by Mel Phillips, with grooming among children as young as the ages of 11 or 12. It states here that, quote, he gave them alcohol and money, wrestled with them, and manipulated their feet for sexual gratification, made them undress and be naked in his presence, and was naked himself, touched their genitals, and forced them to touch his own, attempted to have penetrative sex with them, ejaculated on and in front of them, sometimes videotaped this conduct, and instructed them not to tell their parents. Now, John Doe 6 alleges abuse by Pat Patterson and accuses him of providing alcohol to him, showing him pornography, and forcing him to engage in oral sex. John Doe 3 alleges abuse by Terry Garvin, who by this point was the VP of operations, that placed hands on his shoulders and made a comment that was interpreted as sexual. And so just as well, we'll just circle back to the defendants. We went over kind of the main arguments from Vince and Linda McMahon was about the jurisdiction in Maryland. WWE has argued that even if the plaintiffs have stated a claim against it, the court lacks personal jurisdiction over WWE because none of the parties to this section are citizens of Maryland. Plaintiffs are citizens, and they list off the various states here, while the McMahons were at the time citizens of Connecticut. So the jurisdiction, that was pretty much pushed back on by the judge when TKO made the argument that they should not have to be attached here to the liabilities of WWE. That was also struck down as well, stating that they do assume the liabilities because they are a successor company to WWE because of this 2023 merger with UFC.
Yeah, I don't know how big of a difference it would have made to recovering damages if TKO had been dropped off, but the judge pointed to things including Linda McMahon, who's not a part of either company, but Linda McMahon writing in her declaration that TKO is the successor company of WWE, which is one of the things that was being litigated there. It's important that this case was going to stay in Maryland, right? Because if the defendants had prevailed in this juncture and gotten the case thrown out based on lack of jurisdiction, well, in theory, the plaintiffs
they can't take this to another state. Like the this plaintiffs is the
in
only
theory
state.
Could sue in another state, but the statute of limitations would preclude that in almost every other state except for Maryland, which just passed the Child Victims Act of 2023, which had also been, you know, earlier this year upheld by the state Supreme Court.
It's also noted in this, punitive damages are at least sometimes appropriate in cases of negligence, namely where the negligent conduct is performed with actual malice, characterized by evil motive, intent to injure, ill will, or fraud. Thus, the court declines to dismiss the plaintiff's request for punitive damages at this stage. And it just, it just concludes that the defendant's motions will be granted in part and denied in part in an accompanying order. All three motions will be granted with respect to plaintiff John Doe 7, and Linda McMahon's motion will also be granted with respect to plaintiffs John Doe 1, 3, 4, 5, and 8. The motions will be otherwise denied. So that's where things stand, where outside of John Doe 7, the others are moving forward. All but two have been dismissed as it regards Linda McMahon and, you know, with discovery as the next chapter in this case, it's certainly like it does feel like all four defendants mounted their arguments for why this case should be they should be removed or it should be thrown out. And they largely were unable to convince the judge of that. Is this where they are now going to ramp up an opportunity to just try and settle this and end the suit before it goes into deeper waters?
Another thing about where this is going from here, the judge also the same day that this opinion was filed, put down an order about that they have to meet the parties, plaintiff and defendants have to meet and confer and make a decision about whether the John Does will continue to go forward using those pseudonyms or whether their names will be actually revealed here. Their identities are already known to the defendants. Defendants get to know who's suing them, but they are obviously identified only as John Does and So they're going to meet and confer first, and we'll see if they can come to an agreement without the judge getting involved. That's supposed to happen by January 12th.
Did you see a lot of coverage of this story over the last week?
I saw Axios pick it up. Now, obviously, we haven't mentioned the reason why they would. One Linda McMahon is the Secretary of Education, and she is the former president of the WF, now overseeing the federal department that oversees education, and she's she's involved in she's involved in a lawsuit where she's being accused of negligence related to sexual child abuse, and she's a member of the president's cabinet. So I did see Axios pick it up. Not much else, but I didn't look.
All right. Well, we will be continuing to follow this story. We did reach out to all of the parties, of which they were. No one was speaking publicly at the moment when it comes to the case, which continues on into 2026. Throughout the month of January, you have the chance to lock in your subscription at the Post Wrestling Cafe for all of 2026 before the price increase takes effect February the 1st. Simply sign up before February 1st and you will lock in that price all year long. If that's not enough, this month we have the annual Best and Worst Of show as we get together with the Poison Rana crew to look back at 2025. We're also doing live watch-alongs of the Royal Rumbles from 1990 and 1995 with Brandon from New Jersey, a retrospective on the Tanahashi-Okada rivalry, plus reaction to Wrestle Kingdom 20, a review of TNA's debut on AMC, and much more, including TNA Genesis, UFC 324. It's all found at postwrestlingcafe.com. One person who will be ceasing ties with WWE in 2026, Mick Foley. And what was the breaking point for Mick Foley? Well, you know what? Maybe he tuned into Saturday night's main event, and there in the background, he spots as John Cena goes to a shake hands with Haku there in the background. The only program in the world where in one shot you can see Haku and RFK Jr. in the background, as well as Nick Khan as well. What a trinity. So the many faces of Foley, probably not crazy about this in Washington, but then comes the horrific story involving the murders of Rob and Michelle Reiner and Donald Trump's subsequent post on Truth Social on Monday. And that was it. That was Mick Foley's breaking point. He wrote a statement. "While I've been concerned about WWE's close relationship with Donald Trump for several months, especially in light of his administration's ongoing cruel and inhumane treatment of immigrants and pretty much anyone who looks like an immigrant, reading the president's incredibly cruel comments in the wake of Rob Reiner's death is the final straw for me. I no longer wish to represent a company that coddles a man so seemingly void of compassion as he marches our country towards autocracy. Last night, I informed WWE Talent Relations that I would not be making any appearances for the company as long as this man remains in office. Additionally, I will not be signing a new Legends deal when my current one expires in June. I love WWE, will always treasure my time with them, and I'm deeply appreciative for all the opportunities they afforded me. But in the words of Popeye the Sailor, I stands all I can stands, and I can't stands no more." The end of Mick Foley's run in WWE. Quote Popeye, nevermore.
Until what? How long has Trump been in office? Since this year. So what, 2029 or so he'll be back, maybe?
Perhaps right after, maybe he'll wait till Inauguration Day 2029. So that would be what you could circle your calendar on. I mean, I will say this. It seems like people are divided on like Mick Foley opting to take this stand now in light of what the company has been through. I would generally place Mick Foley in a pretty select number of company that might be at odds with certain issues that the company has engaged in, and is one of the few that I think will actually put some kind of action behind it. And I can't say, like, you can certainly go through, there's been many controversies, and Mick Foley has been someone that has, you know, spoken pretty glowingly of Vince McMahon over all of these years. But I mean, when you look at somebody that his response to Survivor Series 97 was going home and being willing to quit, when it was speaking out against Eddie Guerrero's exploitation, when Foley was right in the midst of a WrestleMania program, and this as well. Like, we talk a lot about performers that you know, don't put a, like, this is such a fear-driven industry for performers that do not want to rock the boat, do never want to jeopardize their income. And granted, this is not his full-time income with WWE. It's a very small percentage he's probably retaining for a Legends deal. But this is some kind of action, and I don't think we have to play this game where it's you have to leave this company on our terms, and you have to make, like, this is a decision that I could guess that almost nobody else is going to make such a decision in this. So anyway, any of your thoughts on this? And I guess Mick Foley's
I certainly what's a Legends deal worth? I mean, it's probably not a huge risk to him, right? Hopefully Mick Foley has saved his money and is doing well for himself. Maybe a Legends deal is not going to break the bank for him. But yeah, I mean, without getting into the terrible Rob Brier news and Mr. Trump's response to it, you know, it's understandable.
Yes. Well, we did not have Donald Trump at Saturday night's main event on Saturday. This would have been where he went. He went to the Army Navy football game on Saturday. That was his outing.
I did see him walking onto the field at the Army Navy football game. We did have other cabinet members here. We did have Linda McMahon was there. Dr. Oz, Howard Lutnick, RFK Jr. I forget this individual's name.
So RFK Jr. did do the double header. He did the football game and Saturday night.
Was he at the football game?
Oh, I thought that. What are you showing this? Where is this from?
This is from the John Cena event.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were showing. Okay, so this was. All right, so Howard Lutnick made it there. Linda. Well, that's nice. Isn't that nice? We also failed to mention during the Cena tribute video at the end of the night, we did get a retroactive clip of Vince McMahon on screen, identified. And but not there live in attendance. And I would say that the outrage was not about any Vince McMahon. It was the booking of Cena that was the outrage.
There was no
outrage.
Response from the crowd unless they muted it. I don't think they did.
No. I mean, it did seem like John Cena was seeing it. Like, I don't think he knew what was going to be in this video either. So I'm sure he was watching that like anyone else, seeing Vince McMahon pop up on the screen
after all those video packages, none of which included Vince, right? And then that was the big payoff, to finally include Vince in a video package.
Mm-hmm. You know, you are someone that sometimes can look at the philosophical messages that come out. Did you have any strong read into
what does it mean?
Professional wrestling has destroyed sports entertainment tonight.
Is that what Michael Cole said? I heard someone say that. That's what he said.
That's what Michael Cole said for the right after the tap.
I would advise against reading too much into things that Michael Cole says.
Okay. I don't think it was a Michael Cole line. That would be my guess.
It was fed to him. Well, or it was prepared. Is that what you're saying?
It's interesting because it was not only part like a big part of the video recap on Monday, like they emphasized that line. But if you also go back to WrestleMania 40, and what was that whole WrestleMania in Philadelphia an exercise in? That was the whole
era.
That was the whole new era weekend of, hey, this is the new company. And when Cody Rhodes wins that title, I'm paraphrasing, but the line was something like, professional wrestling wins. I mean, it was another one where you can certainly draw like these little things if you want to be a little conspiratorial, which is fun to do every now and then.
And that would be about Vince at WrestleMania 40, because that's April 2024, right? And Vince is now we're three months removed from the most recent Vince resignation. But what would John Cena's retirement have to do with that?
Sports, I think you could look at it like this was, you know, for many people, and I wouldn't agree with this, that like, I think John Cena is sort of representative of sort of the end of the Vince McMahon era, even though, I mean, you could certainly attach Roman Reigns to that. Cody Rhodes technically was, you know, a Vince McMahon signing, but I think it's symbolic of the morphing
the
from
guy
one
that
to
Vince
the other.
Pushed for all those years is gone.
That's it. The ongoing shareholder lawsuit. I know you are following this very closely. Who is on deck this week? Who is set to be deposed?
We're in the final weeks here. The final depositions are upon us. And according to the filing, this is, of course, this is a shareholder lawsuit from shareholders against Vince McMahon and various members of the board of directors at the time of Vince's return. And according to a filing that we have here from the Delaware court, Nick Khan is being deposed, perhaps as we speak.
Oh.
He's being deposed today and tomorrow. So just like WrestleMania cannot be contained to one day anymore.
How would this do on Peacock?
I would watch every minute of it. He is being deposed today and tomorrow, according to this filing, in California at a law firm office. So he's being deposed. Yes, here we go. He's being deposed. They're interested in understanding whether Vince predetermined the merger and acquisition transaction that resulted in TKO. And the theory, to remind everyone, is that Vince knew that the only suitor that would allow him to continue with the company after the transaction was his friend Ari Emanuel. So he allegedly predetermined this transaction with him, and he enticed people like Nick Khan and Paul Levesque to go along with it. They are also defendants. He enticed them because they did get, according to SEC filings, did get sizable multi-million dollar bonuses for the completion of the transaction. So the company is not a party to this lawsuit, is not a defendant, but I strongly believe they're footing the bill for what we call the D&O defendants, the directors and officers who are being sued here. So Vince, who has his own separate counsel, and then we have Nick Khan, Paul Levesque, George Barrios, and Michelle Wilson. They are the D&O defendants.
Okay. Do you think this will be part of the maybe this ongoing shareholder lawsuit? Maybe it won't be in time for the hardcover release of George Barrios's book, but maybe the softcover release
with a special
bonus chapter on his role in with the D&O side of things.
One can only hope. Should I go through all these slides here? I'll try to go through them quickly without getting too boring, because we've got some news here. So this lawsuit, which was originally filed back in November 2023 by one Dennis Palkin, who the internet tells me is a university professor. He filed a lawsuit. He had also filed an action to get records from WWE related to meeting minutes for the board of directors meetings. So anyway, he filed a lawsuit. Ohio Laborers Pension Benefit filed a lawsuit. This is a pension fund that saves money for people's retirements. Pontiac, the city of Pontiac Retirees Fund also filed a lawsuit, again, alleging very similar things. There's three complaints here. Two of these complaints are almost identical. They all get consolidated into this one single action, which is captioned in regards to World Wrestling Entertainment merger. And again, we have separate counsel for the two, what I'll call groups of defendants, even though one of the groups is just one person, Vince McMahon. And they all have great lawyers, high profile law firms. I was looking up, like, what is the biggest law firm in the world, or at least the country, is, I believe, Kirkland and Ellis. And then number two is Latham and Watkins. And guess who's defending? Who are the lead counsel for Vince McMahon and for the D&O defendants? It's Kirkland and Ellis for Vince. It's Latham and Watkins for the D&O defendants, which I understand Endeavor and TKO do a lot of work with. So they've got excellent lawyers here. There it is. I did put it in here. So as we've gone through, we've done a lot of reporting on this lawsuit, and I feel it is one of the most, I would say, is probably the most underreported story in wrestling. And because we're pretty far into this case, as I mentioned, you know, Nick Khan is being deposed today and tomorrow. This, you know, unlike the Grant lawsuit, is not stalled. It's well into discovery. Discovery is almost completed. They've got a tentative trial date set for June next year. And it is intertwined with the sexual misconduct allegations, but mainly this is a lawsuit that is about whether or not the shareholders got a good deal or not properly. You know, it's whether or not these members of the board of directors who had fiduciary duties actually fully, genuinely explored the best possible deal for shareholders or not. And in these filings, which are, again, in Delaware court, there's a lot of redactions across many different filings. Even in the plaintiff's filings, there are redactions. And if you read the rules, you find out why. There's this great rule that I've learned a lot about lately called Rule 5.1.
I live by this rule.
Yes, it's a great rule. It is one of the many rules in the rules of the Court of Chancery of the state of Delaware. And you find out that, well, it looks like if the plaintiffs file a filing, let's say the complaint, for instance, which has several redactions, the defendants, it says here, any recipient of notice that you're filing something designating confidential information for redaction in response to notice, any recipient of notice may designate additional information for redaction. So parties get to designate certain information to be redacted. And we have not only redacted filings, but we have entirely sealed filings. And then I've learned that as part of this rule one, there's a part of it that says that you can challenge the sealing or the redaction of filings. And you don't just have to be a party to do that, but any person.
A person. You just have to have a pulse.
Any person. Anybody who's a member of personhood can challenge the confidential treatment of a filing. And so if you look into other cases that are in Delaware Chancery Court, which is where so many of these shareholder lawsuits end up happening because everyone gets incorporated in Delaware, I believe, because of beneficial laws that they have there. So if you look at as recently as this year, you'll find filings where ProPublica, which people may have heard of, is a nonprofit journalistic publication that has filed many challenges to confidential treatment in at least two cases involving, I believe these are cases involving Elon Musk. So on the 9th of December, which is now, just over a week ago, I did file a challenge to the confidential treatment of about 25 different filings that are on this W shareholder litigation docket, including all of the filings that already have public versions of them, but do contain redactions, and then another set of filings that are largely exhibit filings, which are allowed to be filed under seal without a public version, but you can still challenge them. But there's also this one filing, which is the DNO defendant's answer to the complaint, which was filed several months ago, that did not have a public version. So we are hoping to find that too. We could talk about the public interest, but we also came to an agreement, the parties and I did, that they will
and
have.
You just to set this, you are representing yourself in this.
I'm a pro se, what's called a pro se litigant. I'm representing myself here. I wrote these filings all myself, completely written by me. And so we've come to an agreement here. And I emailed back and forth with attorneys, mainly for Vince's lawyer, to come to an agreement about what deadlines that they would have to file certain filings that they're required to file. So they've agreed, they wanted to extend one of their deadlines out so that they could file their motions to maintain confidential treatment at a time that made more sense. So they were going to have to file their motions to maintain confidential treatment by yesterday, but we agreed that instead you'll file all the public versions of the things that do not yet have public versions by the 23rd, which is next week's Tuesday. And then on the 30th, which is the following Tuesday, that will be your deadline to file your motions to maintain the confidential treatment that you do want to maintain. At that point, I will have 5 business days the following Tuesday, which I believe is January 6th, to file an opposition if I wish, where I can make an argument saying, no, I think more of this information should be disclosed.
Merry Christmas. I mean, this is the gift that, I mean, is on everyone's wish list this year to see these confidential depositions that you have filed for. But I think it's, I think I agree with you. I think this is like one of the, like this is a major case that is sort of just operating sort of in the fringes. And there are so many significant depositions that you have outlined that have gone down here, not the least of which are Nick Khan today and tomorrow. But as we've mentioned, like Ari Emanuel, Vince McMahon, Paul Levesque, Mark Shapiro, like there are
everyone has been deposed here.
Everybody of power within TKO. And
I don't want to give anybody any. This is going to be a long process for one thing.
Yes.
What I've challenged are the, so what you can challenge are the filing are the documents that have been filed. Yes. What you cannot challenge. I cannot challenge documents that haven't existed yet. Right. Like, yeah. I filed this on the 9th. Nikon has not had not been deposed by that point. I cannot say, give me the deposition transcripts. In fact, I can't challenge any sort of deposition just because it exists. It has to be something that it has been filed on the docket. And as I've tried to mention here when we've talked about this case, just because depositions happen don't mean that they necessarily become part of the case. They become part of the case if somebody files it or references it as an exhibit in their filing. So maybe we will be covering and watching this closely. Maybe I will end up doing further challenges once more documents and more depositions, more information that may be sealed ends up being filed as sealed or ends up being filed as redacted. So
let me play their defense here of I make my argument on behalf of any of these parties that these depositions, we have not done anything wrong. These are confidential. This is a confidential deposition. What does the public have to gain by having access to any of this information beyond just their base level of curiosity when this is a private matter?
Well, for one thing, this is a lawsuit involving many members of the board of directors who were directors at the time of WWE, and that includes all the defendants on the right, and they are not only former directors. Now, WWE doesn't have its own dedicated board anymore because it's under TKO, but some of those members, including Nick Khan, are members of a publicly traded company. I believe George Berrios he is no longer a member of the board of directors for WWE, nor is he a member of the board of directors for TKO. He's still the director for another company.
And noted author in waiting.
Can't wait. And if there's truth to the plaintiff's allegations that this was a predetermined deal between Vince and Ari Emanuel, well, that's reflecting on Ari Emanuel as well, who is the executive chair of the TKO board. So this is in the public interest. And when we say the public interest, we don't just mean that, and we don't really mean it all. I don't mean it all. These are things that people will click on or read or just want to know out of their own curiosity. Public interest in this context means, well, it's a public benefit. Informing the public so that they can understand, particularly when it comes to publicly traded companies that any retail investor could buy shares in, or that your retirement savings may be, partly depending on, along with a lot of other publicly traded companies. And TKO is not just any publicly traded company. There are many, many, many publicly traded companies, but it is a publicly traded company that's big enough to be now listed in the S&P 500. So it's on the high end of big corporations at this point.
So just to recap, you mentioned in your dates, so December 23rd, what will they be filing on December 23rd?
They will be filing public versions of all the filings that to this point we've never seen at all. So they will be filing public versions of entirely sealed filings. So right now I can look at the docket and I can see that these filings are on the docket, but I can't open them. They are confidential sealed filings. They will have to file public versions of them. I have a feeling they will contain some redactions. That's what they'll file at that point.
Well, I have a hunch that there will be some black ink, but in that, maybe some notable material as well. So that will be next Tuesday. And I applaud you going this direction. I think there are a few that would look at this and see a pathway toward this, but you have a great understanding of the obligations of a lot of these entities in terms of what they are held to and what a lot of people don't venture to try and challenge.
And I should mention, I will, you know, they will release public filings on the 23rd. They are expected to file motions to maintain confidentiality on the 30th. I will consider filing a opposition to that motion on January 6th. Ultimately, this will be up to the judge, vice chancellor. They have chancellors and vice chancellors in the Delaware Chancery Court. This will be up to Vice Chancellor J. Travis Laster to decide who is the jurist overseeing this case. And this is a court of equity, which means if this case does end up going to trial, this is not a case that would have a jury. It would be decided by Vice Chancellor J. Travis Laster himself. So I've been reading up on him. It's been a fascinating time as well, because sure. This is Delaware Chancery Court, where it's just tons of corporate litigation.
It's a fun time.
Yes, if
you can make the trip. Come to Delaware. Last few items here. We've got the Nielsen gauge for November. So what did we get in this breakdown? Always a very beautiful graph. Streaming accounting for 46.7% of viewing, and that is broken down. Leading the pack on streaming is, of course, YouTube with a 12.9% of the share of the pie, ahead of Netflix at 8.3%. Now, why is that interesting? Because this is going to be a debate that I think will certainly trickle into 2026 about what is the share of the market. Is Netflix a monopoly? Is YouTube part of the pie that it is going to be compared to? I think this discussion will certainly continue. Broadcast accounting for 23.2% of viewing, and cable there at 20.5%. As all shit goes, look to fight over 20.5% of your viewing time.
Do you know I have a spreadsheet that tabulates each monthly iteration of the Nielsen gauge?
You could not say something less surprising to me.
Yeah. So, so what I do for one thing, this will be less interesting, but I do put together a bar chart based on the latest iteration, which is the one we just looked at, looking just at the streaming part of that donut chart to look at, well, what are, how do they compare when looking at it a little more closely here? And it's the same information, right? No sleep on here, by the way. I hope they argue. I hope Netflix argues that in antitrust, that sleep is actually their competition. But anyway, what I do here is I combine each monthly iteration of the cable and the broadcast to combine it to be just added together to be one traditional TV metric. And this is looking across, I believe, the entire history of the gauge going back to where we got here, May 2021. They've been doing this since. And then I compare that to the entire streaming portion. And it has been happening since May of this year. Streaming is now just a little bit bigger in terms of watch time than the combination of cable and broadcast.
And thus, the situation that we're in now. Look at this. It's just a gigantic, this looks like an alligator eating up the existing difference here.
Yes.
We also have, do you want to explain what this is a new system that might be in play that you have discovered?
A new system?
What is this last item you had here?
I sent you a very large PDF here yesterday from something called VAB, which puts together all sorts of data. They intend to be business to business, so I had to give them my WrestleNomics email address to get access to this thing. Anyway, they put together a big slide deck, which I thought was very interesting, where they've done kind of similar to what my big data plus panel versus panel only study was. Let's look at same telecasts, new system versus old system, and what's the difference? And I've marked which pages are most interesting, 9 and 38. So if we go to page 9, I'm not showing it on the screen yet. If we go to page 9, and it shows, for example, here, what does it say? The level of variability on trading demos, which means ad demos with audiences guarantees is certainly excessive. So anyway, what they're saying here is that if you look at demos such as 18 to 34, the younger half of what we've long called the key demo, look at 18 to 49, 25 to 54, and the difference in measurement is across 33 networks they took, and they said the difference in measurement is more than 20% lower 27% of the time. It's 20% higher 30% of the time. It's off by 20% half the time. Again, this is old model versus new model. And I also wanted to look at page 38, which had something different on it. I think just looking at just like one particular network, for example, they have anonymized these networks here, thank God, so that we don't know which networks they are. But showing that cable entertainment network number one, analyzed hour by hour, average audience, big data plus panel versus panel only over 4 weeks from September, in September and October 2025. So this is probably right at the beginning of it. And they found that there was a negative 20% difference in demos 40% of the time, 56% of the time, 58% of the time, depending on which demo we're talking about. There was a more than 50% difference. It was 50% lower, 10% of the time, 7% of the time, 4% of the time. Just to illustrating, and there's different examples they go through, is illustrating how strong these differences are between the old method that Nielsen has been using versus the new method.
Yeah, this is a...
Well, one takeaway I would say is that, well, wrestling is not the only one who's having some negative effects here.
Yeah, it seems to be this is one where certainly it is the younger demos that are being hurt of the programs that you are seeing impacted. Of course, there is many examples of programs that have been greatly boosted by these. But when it comes to entertainment programs, I think that is in particular what has been kind of focused upon in these charts, and the propensity of how off some of these numbers are. Like, it's when you're talking like 40% of the time. I mean, this is like, it's extraordinary to me that it, like, what this story would be if this were impacting, forget the NFL, but just even like a secondary like sports like league. You know what I mean? Like, this would be a gigantic issue if larger scale properties were having this impact. I'm surprised that pro wrestling has not gained more attention to this, but I think it's largely because there's been, like, look at these NFL games on Thanksgiving Day that are setting record audiences, and this is looked at as, this is a boost to those numbers, is big data plus panel. But if this had been an anchor on those numbers, I think this would largely be a way more skeptical viewing apparatus if this were having a negative effect on your NFL programming, your NBA games, and such.
And they do show some, there is some NFL data here. We're showing with, again, anonymized networks, NFL broadcast network number three, where they're showing that in the demos, you know, what is the percent of hours more than 10% lower? And it's zero.
Zero.
It's zero. 15%. None. Right. There is some on the other networks that may be the one that fared the best. But it's not as much as, it's not right. There are negative differences, but the positive differences are greater.
The big four networks are not sending you a strongly worded statement about big data plus panel.
Exactly. Right. CW doesn't have any NFL. I think it's what does it have? It's got some, I think it's got some ACC college football. It's got some NASCAR, right? But it doesn't have college football. It doesn't have a lot of college football. It doesn't have NFL. It doesn't have NBA. So they probably felt freest to speak their mind.
Well, maybe SmackDown is trying to come out of the hole, because on Friday night they did 1,240,000 viewers and a 0.26 in the demo. This was their largest audience since September 19th. Before Big Data Plus Panel, only a 2-week high though in 18 to 49. So this is more so an older audience. And what was the draw for SmackDown? John Cena plastered front and center on the advertising. John Cena celebration one night before his retirement match. That celebration shown in a 90-second video package of various
athletes. Was he there in person?
No, of course not. No, this was a...
But you got to see a video package of John Cena.
You got to see a video... Well, you got to see a video package of athletes thanking John Cena. You know, if you're curious what Peyton
Manning... What'd you think of that? You had Peyton Manning, Eli Manning, Jimmy Kimmel, the other guy from the Tonight Show. Did somebody just go through their Endeavor Rolodex and just like be like, hey, you mind recording a cameo for John Cena?
Oh, I'm sure all these celebrities did this on their own and they just sent them in on their own. I'm sure they weren't asked or anything like that. This was a huge moment. But the big breaking news, everyone. You know, we talked about historical events, history draws. You want to be in attendance for big historical shows. Does it get any bigger? Then January 2nd, SmackDown returns to its 3-hour format. And what better place than Buffalo, New York to return to the 3-hour era of SmackDown. I'm sure your city is just counting down.
How is that doing? I've been watching how it's doing. It wasn't doing too impressively last I looked, but then again, it's, you know, there's a few weeks here left.
I don't want to get too ahead of things because I feel we did this last year, like a few weeks out from the holiday tour, and some of the advances, they were not looking all that great. But by the time we got there, it was very much, they move a lot of tickets at the end. But I will say, like,
6,499.
That's for SmackDown in Buffalo.
Yes.
Well, I'm sure.
As of 6 days ago.
If you look at that post-Christmas set of holiday shows, like, it's not crazy numbers. And that could be a case of a lot of people waiting until closer to the show when maybe prices come down and such. But for the whole argument of, like, scarcity and we're going to run all these live events in these big markets after Christmas, it's not like these are, you know, huge, wild numbers that they are drawing for what is now their only set of domestic house shows for the entire year.
Yeah, when I think it was SmackDown was here in Buffalo last, I rode my bike to the arena and I walked, I locked it on some, I don't know if I even locked it on a bike rack, but I locked it somewhere. And
wait,
I walked
was this not the SmackDown that you spent 3/4 of the show on the phone?
I did spend virtually all of the show in the stairwell on the phone.
I remember the show.
It was journalism related though. Don't worry.
It was. Yes.
Yes. And I will not be doing that this time. I just walked up to the box office and I bought a ticket. Let's see. The looks like the get in rate here is $63, but most of these look like they're $87.
Not unreasonable for this day and age. So that is coming up January 2nd as SmackDown moves to 3 hours, presumably for around the 6-month period that we had this past year, and will be a continuation of the USA Network era. Just slowly killing me. And Raw. Huge return to the global top 10 rankings with a charting at number 10 on the rankings for the December 8th edition of Raw. This did 2.5 million views, 4.4 million hours viewed. And the global top 10 was led by Man versus Baby, the Sean Combs documentary, and Stranger Things. So it only ranked in 3 countries, 5th in the U.S., 10th in Canada, and it also ranked in Trinidad and Tobago. I don't want to sound the alarm, but when Bolivia falls off, folks, you heard it here first. That's a sign, okay?
When Bolivia fall off?
Bolivia, it did not rank. SmackDown usually only, they can guarantee one ranking, and it's Bolivia, and Bolivia had no wrestling in its top 10, so I don't know, folks. Bolivia is my bellwether for WWE popularity worldwide.
Stranger Things still... This is, looks like all 5 seasons of Stranger Things still ranked, but at least you know, coming off the huge high that they had been crowding out the top 10 with up to that point. This Man versus Baby, that's Mr. Bean there.
Yes, this is Rowan Atkinson. I won't be watching this. This is 4 episodes of him handling a baby.
All right.
Yeah. I wonder if your algorithm takes you from a Man versus Baby right into the Sean Combs documentary. Could you imagine like falling asleep to Mr. Bean and you wake up to, you know, lotion and tales of abuse?
Yeah. Well, hopefully.
And then right into Stranger Things. I mean, Netflix has you covered for the Christmas holidays.
Hopefully Netflix has something in their methodology that discounts viewership while people are asleep.
Who knows? All right, everybody. There you go. You're all caught up to date now. A very thorough edition of Pollock and Thurston, if I do say so myself. So what is happening over the next couple of weeks? We are going to be off next Wednesday.
Oh, yeah.
It is Christmas Eve, and we are going to give each other the Wednesday off. So Instead, we will be back. Are we coming back on New Year's Eve? Is that our plan?
Yeah,
on
sure. Wednesday? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So we will be back December 31st with a show. Maybe look back at all the greatness that we covered over the past year. We will see what's coming up. So 2 weeks time, we'll be back. Maybe we'll have documents. Maybe we'll have some documents for Brandon to go through.
We'll see. Yeah, we missed our opportunity earlier when we were discussing WBD to raise the all important question. What does this mean for AEW?
A brand new segment coming to Pollock and Thurston in 2026. This will be a weekly segment that we are going to introduce where we really missed the boat on our WBD discussion because that's the question I had at the end of all of this. This hostile bid being rebuffed by Warner Brothers Discovery shareholders.
What is Bix scolding me about here? The Bix language police are out. I've said, what have I done? Who's Edmund Blackladder?
That is Rowan Atkinson's other notable. You want to know a funny Mr. Bean story? Kind of funny. No one was harmed too significantly in the process. When I was 13 years old, me and my friends, two of my friends, we were going to go watch the Mr. Bean movie, and we had to switch buses at this rather busy intersection. And so we get off one bus and we jaywalked. Very bad idea. I turn around. My friend is there laying on the ground where he has been struck by a car. And he gets up and he got hit here. And we go sit. Ambulance has to come. They're like checking him out. And then we convince him that, you know, he'll be okay. He'll be fine. And then I was like, our movie's in 20 minutes. What are we going to do here? And like, well, let's go watch the Mr. Bean movie. So we went. He ended up like, I don't know if he had broken ribs, but he definitely had bruised ribs.
And he watched the Mr. Bean movie.
He watched the Mr. Bean movie after this. Wow. And it was, so folks always wait for the light. That's my lesson. Even if you're in a rush to go see, the Mr. Bean film in 1997.
Okay. That's an important moral to the story.
Yeah, that's my lesson for the day. All right, everybody. We're off next week. Back in 2 weeks. Thank you so much for listening and watching to Pollock and Thurston. Goodbye. I think I just shocked everybody. Goodbye.
Thank you for calling the Bombas Comfort Line. Bombas make socks, slippers, tees, and underwear made with the highest quality materials. Press 1 for comfort, 2 for style, 3 for donation.
You chose style. Bombas is styles for whatever you enjoy. You can run in Bombas, lounge in Bombas, dress them up, dress them down, but always give back in Bombas. Because with every item purchased, another is donated. Bombas, comfort worth calling for. Go to bombas.com/audio and use code AUDIO for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com and use code AUDIO.
This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.